WNST, Towson Baltimore, and Baltimore Positive. We positively have some great sponsors around here. I want to thank first and foremost our newest sponsor is Taharka. I have Honey Graham ice cream here. Moeller is going through about 8 pints of this over in Catonsville. The pandemic's going to put 20 pounds on him, and our friends at Taharka are helping that. Made here in Baltimore, as well as our friends at State Fair. I made it out to Evan. Don Moeller, you saw the bag. What did I order on Tuesday?
Well, there was no doubt in my mind there was some chicken and waffles in there, and you know, let me see. You probably had some shrimp and grits.
No.
How am I doing so far?
No. I just got the chicken and waffles. I made it very easy. I did bring my wife home some of the raspberry sauce. She's very appreciative of that. She's going to use that on a biscuit this morning. Also, our friends at Fadley's. Don has curbside Fadley's. I curbside Fadley's last week. Crab cakes, they're delivering them all over the world, as well as crab and mac and cheese and crab soup and crabs. All of that at Fadley's in Lexington Market. And, of course, Moeller & Gary Realty. Don's son, Jeff, you can find him out in the buyatoyota.com audio vault. We're hoping to. Have you elbow bumped your grandkids yet, Don, or no?
That's about it. We elbow bump. We're doing a little book club. We're trying to stay connected, but there aren't any hugs in that stuff.
All right. Well, this is going to be a fun one because usually you've known the guests way longer and better than I know the guest. But I know this guest a long time. This guy was one of my mentors. I'll never forget the first time he took me to the little luncheonette on Calvert Street, and I told him when I was a grown-up I wanted to be him. This is back when, I think it was on BAL in the late 1980s. He's been everywhere. I have been a guest in his kitschy kitchen. He didn't have me on YPR as much and like that because he didn't think I was erudite enough, but I love me some Dan Rodericks, who's one of the three adults ever to take me fishing as an adult out into the real world. And Dan, I love you. I read your work. We get together every couple of years and get a coffee or whatever. But I don't put you on the radio often enough. For being a guy who's got a radio, I don't share your wisdom with the world. So I do appreciate you taking some time today, brother.
Oh, and that's it. That remark about WYPR and not booking you for that show, it's not because you're not erudite enough. It's just, it's a little startling, I think, for public radio listeners to hear you.
You had me on one time, and he had me on one time, Don, and he never invited me back, and I was in Denver, it was the day, and I was in a bad mood. It was the beginning of the Ravens season, we had won the Super Bowl, and I was in Denver, and Keith Urban was at the Harbor. It was the day we played a baseball game instead of kicking off the football season. And I did your show that day. I remember that. And I probably was a little salty that day, even though the weather was nice in Denver.
Assuming that the YPR listeners, they don't like to have to adjust the volume. So turning the volume up and down when you had Nestor on, that was a little tough for them. You know, they don't go for that.
It was an aesthetic thing, really, more than anything else.
I'm going to get ganged up on in this one, I have a feeling. Dan, you've written as much about the election, and I know you know about Baltimore Positive. We were in Fadley's at the same time, I think, the day that Mary Miller came down and did our show, which feels like months ago, and we all had freedoms then, right? You know, I follow you and your wisdom and looking at the platforms and looking at the people. The ballot is literally in my hand. I was going to say it's out on the counter. It's not. It's literally on my desk. I left it here yesterday. I haven't filled mine out yet. And the really weird part is I've spent a couple of hours with all of these candidates, and I really don't know whom I'm voting for, and I don't know that I've met the candidate that's the visionary that's going to fix Baltimore. I don't know that I've met that person.
Well, I've met or listened to all of them, the top six anyway, and actually a seventh, who's not considered in the top six anymore. And I'm sort of where you are today. My ballot is sitting on my desk, too, and I'm debating who to vote for mayor. This is a very interesting election. I've heard some people, speak negatively of all the candidates. I don't feel that way about them. I think there's some good candidates in here. They all have qualities to offer the city. And It's a tough decision. I've actually never seen a primary like this. In 1983, Billy Murphy ran against William Donald Schaefer, and that was pretty interesting, but Schaefer won in a landslide. But nothing like this. So people, if you haven't, who are listening and haven't made up their minds yet, they ought to do some more reading about the candidates. You can go back and watch some of the debates that are online. This has been a very strange period because of the pandemic. You know, most of the campaigning has been done online virtually. You know, the debates, the candidates have been at home or in their offices, not appearing with each other. So it is very strange. And the dynamic of the pandemic and the crime in the city is what I deal with in my column on today. This is Wednesday. You know, a few months ago, what would you have said was the top issue on voters' minds? Would have said crime, right? And maybe it still is, and maybe it never went away as the number one issue for Baltimore City voters. But with the pandemic and the crisis that the city is facing and other jurisdictions are facing because of the economy, the hit on the economy, people have a lot to consider here. Like, who's going to be the mayor, not just to deal with the crime and to steward us through that, but also to get us through this economic crisis in the city as a result of the pandemic and the health crisis that will continue for months. So,
Dan, you raised so many points there. I ask you to continue with a couple. One, I agree with you. We have, and again, I encourage folks to jump back on BaltimorePositive.com and listen to the interviews with each of the candidates. We literally have more than 2 hours worth of interviews, unfiltered, long-form interviews where they can begin to really finalize a decision as to who they're going to vote. I agree with you, Dan. I think people do a disservice to this group of candidates when they disparage them, because I think there are several in this group of six who actually have potential to be pretty darn good mayors, and I'm encouraged to hear you say that as well. When you say that, Dan, you have a high bar, and we're going to talk a lot in the next 40 minutes or so. You have a high bar of what a mayor should be. What do you want the next, forget the person, what do you want out of the next mayor?
I want a mayor who has a specific vision about how to get through the pandemic and also has ideas about what's going to reduce crime, but doesn't also get in the way of this police commissioner who's only been on the job a little more than a year. So I think those two things are important. But I also look to see, who are they going to attract to work in the administration of City Hall? I mean, we need some good people besides the mayor to run things, the housing department, the public works department, you know, parks and recreation. You need good people all the way through. And one of the things I worry about with Sheila Dixon, for instance, I'll start with her, is not so much her past, but who is she going to bring in? And what kind of a coalition can she develop in the city? Because I think the city is really divided on whether Sheila Dixon should be mayor or not. You have, based on the last poll we saw, this race is between Mary Miller and Sheila Dixon, with Brandon Scott right there on both their heels. So, you know, I look to see who has the potential to bring in quality people to work in this administration. Actually, the current mayor, Jack Young, I feel has done a pretty good job with that, that he has a pretty good staff already in place. We've seen him look right past Jack Young. People in the polls don't seem to be very impressed with him as a mayor, although, you know, you got to give him credit for having a pretty steady hand on things since he took over only a year ago in May of 2019.
Well, and Dan, one thing I want to say about Jack, not to be completely interrupted, but he got 173,000 votes in 2016 for city council president. I mean, I went to Ballotpedia and I looked at that. I mean, we're talking about Sheila getting 46,000 and then 51,000, you know, back in 2016.
Right.
To look at the math, Jack got 173,000 people to fill a bubble in for him. I've driven around the city. There are a whole lot more Jack Young signs on lawns than maybe the pollsters would tell you. And this is where Mueller and I get sideways, Dan, where we talk about these pollsters and the science of polling and where all this is, where 22-25% say undecided. I mean, it's almost as though no one thinks Jack can win at all or will have a turnout on Tuesday. I think Jack's going to be a factor in the race because I think people are going to vote. I think some people are going to vote for him, even though nobody's talking about him.
Yeah, I tend not to look past him just yet, partly for the reason you state. also because, well, I think what works against Jack is that he's been around for a long time. You know, he went to city council in the 1990s, and he's been here through all this turmoil of the last 5 to 7 years, and so that's working against him. You also have in Baltimore an influx, even though we've lost some population, you have an influx of young progressives, millennials, who are probably sick of the status quo, are probably looking to somebody else, looking to somebody younger like Brandon Scott maybe, or someone like Mary Miller, somebody new, even through Vignaraja, who could attract younger voters or people at least concerned about crime. I don't know if he gets the progressive vote because of some things that have come up during the campaign with Vignaraja. But, you know, of all the people I spoke with, the one who has the most new, fresh ideas, is almost prolific when it comes to new policy ideas, is Vignaraja. You know, but he doesn't seem to have gained any traction, or he lost some voters with some revelations about his connection with Sinclair, WBFF, that crowd, and the surveillance plane that he supports turns off some of those progressives I'm talking about. So,
but Dan, didn't he also lose momentum? And you've covered so many things over the years where politicians sort of step outside the lane, so to speak. From where you sit and the folks you talk to, it seems to me that Theroux really had the wind at his back, and then there were a couple of personal videos that surfaced. It sense to me that if it didn't necessarily knock him all the way down, it seems to me that it froze him in place. What was your take of the impact of those videos?
Well, you know, I hear from people all over the city. I think I have a pretty good set of contacts in different parts of town across racial lines and class lines. And the incident with the police stop on Greenmount Avenue, 1 o'clock in the morning, back in, what was that, September, and questioning the police officer about his body camera and then asking him to turn it off. I went over all that again. You know, it's a strange situation. If you need to go back and watch the whole video, a police sergeant who arrives on the scene actually asks him if he wants him to shut off the camera, and then he does ask him to shut off the camera. But that I think that turned off a lot of people. Even though it's kind of a gray area for me, I don't completely fault him for that. Having met Theroux and talked to him a number of times, I can just see him asking the question, "Is your body camera on?" Not something I would ask a police officer who stopped me at 1 o'clock in the morning.
Well, I mean, we had him on the show, Dan, and I quite frankly said, you know, I got pulled over a couple of years ago in front of my place for a license plate. I said, the one thing I never thought is, does he have a camera on me, and would I ask him to turn it off? You know, it would never occur to me ever to do that to a police officer, and I wouldn't care. I mean, even if my hair looked like I got pandemic hair right now, Dan, and I don't care, you know?
But isn't that
the question? Like, why would you ask? Why would anybody ask?
Right.
Because they were embarrassed. They didn't want the moment recorded. Or Theroux, you hear him, is that because he's in law enforcement, because he was a prosecutor, he was asking, I get the sense, to make sure it was on. You know, it was, I don't know, it's kind of hard to believe that. But I think that, Don, to your point, I think that hurt him some. And when I talk about the young progressives in the city who are going to, these are people who vote, I don't think they're crazy about the idea of the aerial surveillance. The jury's still out on...
Where are you on that, Dan? I mean, that seems to be such a sticky thing, and it's a 21st century thing, and I live downtown, and I see planes, and I see everything in the sky. I don't know why that's so offensive when there was a shooting 8 hours ago, literally 3 blocks from my home, and there and a carjacking, and a police officer was shot on Tuesday night. I don't know why you wouldn't want aerial surveillance. I don't know why. How is that offensive when the door
it's not,
knobs
it's not to
videos?
Me. I support the American Civil Liberties Union, but I don't agree with them on this, or even my own newspaper on this issue. I don't see what the problem is if it gives the police another tool for making an arrest after the fact. I don't think it helps the police in the moment, but it helps them track down someone who, say, robs a store or commits a street robbery or carjacking. So I don't, you know, I don't have a problem with that. To what extent that hurts Theroux, it's hard to tell. You know, as I say in my column today, the poll I want to see is after the election, why the person who won, because there are so many different dynamics in this. You have mail-in ballots for the first time. You know, everybody's doing this by mail now or drop-in. That's a whole nother dynamic that sort of undercuts the so-called ground game of candidates who can get the vote out, who've relied in the past on getting people in buses and cars to go to the polls. Now they're counting on people filling out ballots and mailing them in or dropping them off, right? So there are so many different dynamics in this particular primary, and the person who wins is going to have a plurality of maybe 18% of the vote or something like that, maybe 19%, possibly 20%. So, yeah, this is a real interesting. The city, I've called it the most important city election of the 21st century because we need to get out of this tailspin that we're in. And I say tailspin, it's mostly because of crime. We've had a drop in population. We've had a sense of, you know, government dysfunction. We've had corruption. We lost another mayor to corruption. We had police corruption. It's been such a pileup of problems over the last 5 years, especially, you know, I say 5 years going back to Freddie Gray, that we need somebody to pull us out of this and be a real leader. I mentioned Brandon Scott. I listened to him in the last two debates, and I didn't find him to be particularly forceful in his comments, the way he presented himself. He has a lot of good things to say, a lot of good ideas, holistic ideas about moving the city forward, but I didn't feel like his voice was very strong. I mean, not only physically, but in terms of his personality, how he presented himself as a leader. So some people may think he's just too young still, but I don't know. You got to watch him. He was he got the Suns endorsement, and I didn't have anything to do with that. But
well, this is where the Suns endorsement. I saw visionary. I've sat with all these people, and I agree. And Don, I want to back up from the first thing I said because I don't have anything disparaging to say other than Sheila's track record, which would make her she's disqualified. I'm not voting for Sheila Dixon. I don't think she's the person to move the city forward. I don't think Jack Young. I've sat with these people, but the other mix of people, I am very intrigued by TJ, and we haven't brought his name up. I have found, and he's had no money, and Don and I have talked about this for a year and a half. I've been out on the streets with TJ in various places where I just run into him, and I'm always struck by how many people know who he is, and when this thing shows up, they know his name if they don't have a TV and haven't watched television commercials. I've loved TJ Smith's campaign. I am strongly considering voting for him. I'm trying to think of, can he win? And I've got, you know, Mary Miller and her association with Obama and how much money she's spending. Theroux, who's hard on crime, and Brandon, who might be sort of the consensus candidate that could bring people together in a younger person. But I don't see any of these people. And I know I brought this up with you, and I know you had mixed emotions with Don Donaldo and, you know, back in the day and all that. And I know Schaefer wasn't perfect. And look, I literally in my arm's reach here, I've got Martin O'Malley's book, Smarter Government here. Martin O'Malley came in and ran an 86-day campaign in a similar state. We had Carl Stokes on. He's on the ballot here, still running, and he probably would have, could have, should have been the mayor back in the day, or Lawrence Bell. So the history of all of this is interesting, but we're looking for this visionary thing that when people say, I want Governor Schaefer, there's plenty of people on Billy Murphy's side that would say from that election, well, Governor Schaefer didn't do what some people in the city think that maybe he did or his legacy would be. There was a lot of population flight and a lot of tax base flight during his period of time that wound up costing the city a lot of money as well, right?
Yeah. Well, to bring it up to date here, then you would say, well, I need an executive who's very clearly the leader of the city, who people listen to, who can bring in good, talented people to work for him to get us through this coronavirus period, and then also be dealing with crime. that's a lot, you know. So you might be looking for someone with experience, executive experience. Mary Miller's favor is her experience working in finance. I noted that she got her on the board of Baltimore Community Lending, which is a small community bank on the west side of the city, southwest side of the city, that does a lot of small business and housing lending that the big banks don't do. She involved herself with that, and she talks a lot about, you know, economic justice in the city and trying to redevelop areas that have been neglected for a long time. And that might resonate with a lot of people, that you need someone who's, yeah, they recognize that crime is important, but also you got to deal with the business in the city. You have to bring more business into the city. You have to educate children. We haven't even talked about schools. You know, the mayors since Schaefer have had it pretty easy when it comes to schools, because they, you know, they pretty much let North Avenue run things, and we haven't really had an education mayor in this whole time. So she does talk about that. Theroux has a plan, calls it a Marshall Plan for the schools. And boy, it's a lot. So you have to be looking for a person who can't do it all themselves, is clearly the leader and brings in talented people to work in the city to try to improve it. So I don't know who that is. TJ is interesting because so many people know him from television as a police spokesman. I hear two things about him. Some people associate him with the police department during a period of corruption, even though he was a latecomer to that. I don't put that on him. Other people say this is a guy with some heart. He was a police spokesman, but he spoke about the tragedies. He spoke right about the homicides in the city as tragedies, as daily tragedies. And I think that resonated with a lot of people.
We lost his brother, right? I mean, that it doesn't get any closer to home than that.
Yeah.
The debate, Dan, and I'd love you to weigh in on this. And we were with Dan Rogers a long time, Baltimore Sun-Com. As a matter of fact, before I ask this question, I did the math, Dan. I mean, I'm feeling old, buddy. I got to tell you, because I've read you from day one. I mean, I followed Rose Popola and the lasagna and the whole shebang. Every time you wrote about Rose, I could see my mother in the kitchen. So you have been writing columns for 41 years, if my math is correct. I got out the calculator, which means to me that you have written over 5,000 columns. Is my math accurate?
It's more like 6,000.
Yeah, 6,000.
No, actually, when I hit the 40-year mark, see, they gave me a column when I was 24 years old. Nesta knows this.
Unbelievable.
Nesta talks about me like I'm some old man, but I'm not that much older than Nesta. But anyway, they gave me a column when I was 24 in 1979 on the Evening Sun, a newspaper that doesn't, where Nesta started, where it doesn't even exist anymore.
Who gave you that column? Jack Lemmon?
No, it was before him. It was Philip Heisler. Philip Heisler was the managing editor of the Evening Sun. He had been a longtime Baltimore Sun reporter. He was a war correspondent in the Pacific in the 1940s and during World War II. And then, you know, he gave me a column in 79. And I, you know, was one of the, you talking to me? You really want me to do that? I felt like I'd only been a reporter here for like 3 years. Yeah, so for many years I wrote three a week.
That's amazing.
And then there was a period when I wrote two a week, and then I went back to three a week. So we did the math when I hit 40 years, and it was something like 6,000 columns. And that covered mayors, William Donald Schaefer, Du Burns, Kurt Schmoke, Martin O'Malley, Sheila Dixon, Stephanie Rawlings-Blake, Catherine Pugh. Speaking of Catherine Pugh, I wanted to make a point about the last election. You know, when we ran polls in 2016, it showed that Sheila, trying to make a comeback, was pretty close to Catherine Pugh. And I think a lot of people ended up voting for Catherine Pugh because they did not want Sheila Dixon to be mayor again. That was in 2016. This 4 years later, some people may feel differently this time and want to forgive her and give her another chance. They remember that her term as mayor was pretty good compared to some other periods we've had, in terms of crime especially. So, you know, she's definitely a factor there. But based on the last Sun poll, people who do not want Sheila Dixon to be mayor have to be looking at the two other contenders, Mary Miller or Brandon Scott.
Well, Dan, you know, it's interesting, and then I want to go back and ask you to weigh in on something I'm going to share about CJ and the debate that Nestor and I have. But an interesting fact about the 2016 election, and we've shared this before on the air, is that on election day vote, on the people who voted, which we're not going to have this time, so that changes the whole equation. But on election day vote, Sheila Dixon actually beat Catherine. Catherine won that race based upon the early vote.
And you're right.
Mm-hmm. Obviously, ground forces and the ability to get out the early vote. So, again, we go back. We don't know what vote by mail does to that equation. But
right.
But in the TJ piece, and I like TJ a lot. I consider TJ a friend. I've known TJ for, you know, quite a while. Is that I said to Nestor in the beginning, and we actually had a pollster say to us, Dan, I'd be curious what you think about this. We had Patrick Gonzalez say to us in an interview that had TJ had $1 million, he would win this race by 10 to 15 points. He didn't have $1 million. He literally had basically no dollars. And mm-hmm. what I've suggested to Nestor is that as much as we all want to have this sort of Mr. Smith goes to Washington dream of politics, the reality is you aren't winning a major metropolitan election without a significant war chest. Do you buy that as well?
Yes. I don't know how else you could do it. And I think Gonzalez is correct there, because aside from Sheila Dixon, who had the most name recognition in this? T.J. Smith, who had the highest profile in recent years from television, even more so than Sheila Dixon. I mean, Sheila Dixon was mayor, you know, in 2010 she left office. That's 10 years ago. So there's a whole generation of people who moved into the city or have grown up and become voters since then. I agree with that, but he couldn't get that traction from donors to get the money he needed to get on TV. And yeah, I think that's true. You know, sometimes people vote just in an instinct saying, this guy cares, let's give him a chance. Crime is the major issue. That's his focus. Let's go with that. But what I'm saying to you, and you know this, is that because of the pandemic, there's a whole nother layer of what's needed in an executive who runs a city. Besides just, I don't want to dismiss crime because, you know, we had a terrible Memorial Day weekend again. We had the officer shot last night in Federal Hill. But it's right there with the pandemic thing. Is I don't know how you look around it. It's right there in front of you. You need a mayor to help rebuild the city. And it's not an exaggeration to say it's not unlike rebuilding the city after the Great Fire of 1904.
Right. No, it's you know, it's interesting, Dan, in your paper recently, the former president of WJZ and president of a community association now in the city, Jay Newman, wrote a piece in which he talked about the importance of fiscal management of the next mayor, saying that it will be very, very easy for the next mayor to immediately fall back on what, I don't know if he called it knee-jerk or others do, but the easy fix, which is across-the-board cuts, personnel cuts, let's just slash everything right now. And I think, you know, I think Bill Henry, on recently for us, and he happens to be the only candidate that we've actually endorsed here at Baltimore Positive because we think we need a change in the controller's office. But Bill also talked about the need to resist that and to really have the mayor, the controller, the city council come together, roll their sleeves up, and really begin to have an important discussion about priorities in the city and begin to put the city budget together that way rather than the quick and easy fix of just across-the-board cuts, which may get you a balanced budget, but may not give you a stronger city.
Boy, that's what a challenge that is. I mean, you cannot cut city services anymore. I don't see how you can. The city, you need to have trash pickup. You need to have recreation centers open for kids. There's so much you need to do. And that he's right about that. So he's probably leaning toward Mary Miller on that. When it comes to that, her executive experience in finance is, well, there's no one else in this race who compares to her there. Although Brandon Scott, you know, he has some experience as a city councilman with a budget, and Jack does. But in finding imaginative ways to get the city through this, that would be Mary Miller, if that's what you're looking for. And, you know, she said right from the outset on her TV commercials that she was going to leave crime in the hands of the police commissioner and support him, give him air cover, as she says. And there's a lot of people say, yeah, we've been through too many police commissioners. You got to give this guy a chance. He seems okay. You need a mayor to bring the police union together with the police commissioner. That would be nice to get the FOP on board with this guy.
By the way, as a citizen, that's one of the more disconcerting things for me.
Yeah,
is that
yeah.
that the grown-ups, we can't get a bunch of grown-ups in the room and at least figure out how to work together, because we're going to work together today, tomorrow, and next week, and we serve the people. And you know, I don't feel like the citizens are ever first when I hear those things.
Well, one of the things I worry about with Sheila Dixon would be, if she becomes mayor, how does she pull together this coalition that you need to build across the city, across the races, across the classes, to move the city forward? And I think she's still kind of a divisive candidate. I got to say that on the debate, the NAACP debate that was online a couple of weeks ago now, or was it just last week? I can't remember. she's chastising T.J. Smith over his pension deal with Anne Arundel County and his salary deal with Baltimore City, and using the word corruption. And I'm sorry, I can't go there with. She shouldn't go there, and I can't get on board with that. You know.
Well, there is some audacity in all of it, right, for Sheila. I mean, she's got some chutzpah, you know, to get involved in this. Dan Rodericks is our guest on Baltimore Positive. Of course, former Baltimore County Executive Don Moeller here. Dan, I mean, we talk about these candidates and the other races and Bill Henry and the city council president and trash pickup and all those other things, but I want to give you a little bit of oxygen on Save Our Son. I want to throw a lifeline your way and say thank you for taking me fishing. Tony Tochterman came on recently. Dennis Colazzo is one of my sponsors and dear friends from Coons Ford. He's been going fishing lately. You're the fishing guy. And I guess Save Our Son for me. I worked at the Evening Sun. I have taken this month to share an album a day every day. You remember when I had long hair and I was the music critic around our newspaper. I found one old paper where I was the lead story above the fold on A1. And my wife's really? Like, why did you keep that? And I'm like, that's all you lived for in life was to
man.
Be like on A1. You know, I mean,
what was the story?
It was Pier 6 short on money. It was a news story that Pier 6 was in financial trouble in 1989 or 90. And it was one of those breaking stories that we moved above the fold for the Chaser that day. Yeah, so we're doing right. newspaper. So all of this.
Nestor, hold that. So I've got you make me laugh, and Dan will know this, because he enjoyed Kevin Kamenetz, and he likes covering Kevin, and they two smart guys. They love to spar back and forth. Even at Kevin's funeral, his wife, Jill, made the comment. Kevin's famous line when we thought we had a good story and I was happy about it and something good was happening, and I'd say to him, hey, boss, it's going to get good coverage. This is a good thing. And inevitably, he'd say to me, he had one question. Is it above the fold?
Above the fold.
and then you would say, which page?
We'd have the greatest story in the world. And son of a gun, if it wasn't above the fold, Don, it wasn't above the fold.
Yeah. You know, there are people, you realize, there are people listening who have no idea what we're talking about because they don't hold a printed newspaper in their hands and understand that, right?
Yeah, above the fold, right? Up here.
Yeah.
But Dan, we talk about Sheila Dixon's transgressions. We certainly can talk about Catherine Pugh as, you know, overtly corrupt through all of this. And all of the issues we've had here with the police and the gun task force. And now a Pulitzer Prize, right? Like your institution, which I've had a love, hate, competition mm-hmm. thing for most of my life. I worked there from 86 till 92. All I ever wanted to do was grow up and be Oscar Madison, right? And be a sports writer, right? And seeing where newspapers are and your association with it and the hand-wringing that goes on when these things, that Cleveland goes out of business and New Orleans goes out of business. And what we're talking about with election and transparency and accountability and who holds whom accountable in a country where this TV con man fraud stands up every day and calls you and me fake news. And it really, and I'll get personal on this, but the one thing about the Angelos thing and having my press pass taken away after it's what I did for 21 years was being called fake news by him that really I found that offensive after spending a lifetime, you know, being trained by people like you and Jack Gibbons and Molly Dunham and, you know, professionals on what is fact and what is fiction. And people like you and me and Don, we've been schooled on this forever. We went to journalism school, communication. The general citizen, when they see something on Twitter, I am just astonished, especially people in the red hats, how the game of phone booth has become this proliferation of life that that's become Orwellian. And what stands between that is people believing in what a newspaper writes or what some trusted organization, some organization of higher integrity reporting facts. We've just gotten lost since you and I were younger people, huh?
Yeah. Well, I don't think we're completely lost, but it is very disturbing to me the number of people who don't read a newspaper, have no respect for newspapers, and just turn to Fox News or Facebook or whatever they hear on the AM radio. So I wanted to quote Alex Jones, who's a dean at Harvard, who wrote a book, sort of an essay about the iron core of news. When you look at all the concentric circle of information at the center of it is this iron core of news, which is reported by the wire services, the major national newspapers, the Times, the Post, all the local newspapers that cover their local scenes. This is the iron core of news. If you don't have the solid iron core of news producing news, actually, you know, reporting on government, reporting on business, reporting sports, reporting...
Not the Kardashians, by the way, which has become...
None of that stuff.
Yeah.
That's all way outside that circle. But, even when it comes to celebrity news, you could say some celebrity news is in the iron core because you need to know, you know, when a famous movie star dies or something or does something outrageous. But anyway, in the core there is this where the news comes from. It emanates from. Everything we talk about, everything you guys talk about on the podcast probably emanates in some way from something you read in the newspaper or that you heard on television because some TV news director picked up a story that was reported in the Sun or the Post or something, right? So you have to have that. That needs to be supported. And what we've found out over the last 20 years, especially since the internet, is that unless advertisers support it, it's gonna fade and die. And unless readers support it with subscriptions, it's going to fade and die out. Craigslist came along and knocked classified advertising out of newspapers. That was a slush fund. You know, that was a keen revenue source, important revenue source for newspapers for years. And classified advertising virtually disappeared when Craigslist came along. That was the first big hit. And then as you had more and more corporate ownership and profits, higher and higher profits expected from newspapers by these companies that own them, they devoted less to the resources, and the resources are reporters, photographers, sports writers, editors, copy editors. We have one copy editor at the Baltimore Sun now. The rest of the copy editing is done in a central location in Chicago, but even there, there's not very much of it. When Michael Phelps is in the Olympics and his hometown newspaper does not send their own photographer to cover him, their own reporter to cover him, you know, that's sad to me. That's something that we used to do. We wouldn't even have a second thought about it. So corporate profits and developing and keeping this iron core of news do not go together. It's become very difficult to do, to pull off, to give Wall Street the profits it wants.
Well, then that leads us, Dan, to what Nestor alluded to a few minutes ago.
Save our son.
We love to save our son. We've had Matt Gallagher on. We've had Ted Venatoulis on. Again, I would direct folks, Baltimore Positive, go pull up those interviews. I say to you, as someone who's got decades and 6,000 columns and loves newspapers, and including holding them in her hands, which, as you said, hardly anyone does anymore. They hold their phone instead.
Well, there's still like thousands of people who do that. It's just that there's a lot that you just read it online now.
I agree. So the question becomes, Dan, is a nonprofit alternative the future of the daily newspaper?
Well, remember I talked about WYPR and public radio in the beginning, and I don't know, that's a pretty good model. It's supported by people who want good information and credible news, right? And conversation and to learn things every day. People who have a lifelong love of learning turn to public radio. That's member supported. It's in part supported by some subsidy from the government, but not very much, not as much as it used to be. So why doesn't that model apply for newspapers? And can you make the transition now from an entity that is owned by a corporation to a nonprofit model? I think it can be done. This is a serious bid we have here with two foundations that, have some deep pockets to make a serious financial offer to Tribune. I hope they go for it. One of the major shareholders in Tribune announced the other day that he thinks they ought to be selling off the newspaper to local ownership again. It's a major thing to hear from a major.
Well, the only way it's going to work is to be local, Dan. And this is where I step in and say I spent years trying to put the Sun out of business, right? Like 2006, 7, and 8, when I saw the online opportunity, I thought, I can have a sports section as good as the Sun, or I can do something credible online, and I don't have that printing press down there and those trucks and the unions and all that. That was my thought, was I can get my piece of the pie in sports by having an online newspaper, and I'm built for doing it. I mean, I was trained to do that, right? And then I realized as well that the online model was, on digital pennies for, magazines were still getting, because you could physically touch it, and the buyers wanted that. Where we are now in 2020, though, 15, 20 years into this internet thing, it's no longer an experiment. There's no longer any thought that you're ever really going to deliver the newspaper in that way. And the back and forth for me with Gallagher and with Don is this, and you know this because you try to stay above the fray. You've always tried to stay above the fray to some degree. Everybody wants a newspaper until they investigate you or your buddy or your business or your family or the person on your block or whatever, because newspapers have traditionally been unkind in that way when it comes to facts. And even when Sheila Dixon gets busted and all this stuff happens, she's still on my ballot and she still might win this week. So, and you guys have endorsed Brandon Scott. In the old days, Don and I argue all the time, newspaper endorses somebody. That's it. It's over the top. The power of all of it has gone away, but the power of all of it to exist was that Baltimoreans trusted the Sun, the News American, the Evening Sun, for years. It was a trusted resource, and sort of everybody agreed to it, or most people agreed to it, that it was there, and they put in for it in the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s of last century. I don't know that we're going to get anybody to put in for anything anymore and all sort of agree on one thing. I think that getting to the national level in that race, that is where we are now. We have half the society right now not wearing masks because the Imperial Orange leader told them that it's okay to go out and run around and wait in line for Thrasher's French fries last weekend. Like, getting people to agree on anything, that's the hardest part, that we would all trust the Sun, or that advertisers would trust it. I think that's hard in the modern era.
Mister, I want to challenge you on a couple of things.
Sure.
On the masks, the polls indicate that 60 to 70% of Americans feel we've got this right, that we should be cautious, we should be wearing masks. So it's higher than that. There's some people, I think the last survey I saw, 15% felt we hadn't gone far enough with the stay-at-home orders from governors. And we didn't have a national shutdown. We didn't have a national lockdown like New Zealand did and some other countries did. We didn't have the testing that South Korea put in place almost immediately. So, yeah. But the point you were making about people getting away from newspapers, actually people have started to come back to newspapers in the digital age and in the Trump age. Subscriptions at the New York Times and the Post have gone up. I think the Wall Street Journal says the same thing. And since the pandemic, even more so. And what we hear from our publisher, The Sun, is that digital subscriptions have gone up significantly since the pandemic and since Trump. So since Trump, is interesting to me that people want to turn the newspapers, because I think people are still in shock that Trump became president, although 63 million people voted for him. There's a lot of people who just can't believe that this has happened. It's still today are still stunned that he is the president and don't believe and trust anything he says. So they turn the newspapers. To me, that seems like a natural thing. I don't know where else you would go.
Well, the one thing that's definitely come out of this is we're all looking for something we can trust, right? I mean, we're all looking for something we can trust at this point, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think there's some hope there that people who want... Look, I've discovered, you know this, that there's a lot of people who just don't care. They don't read the news. They don't listen to the news. They don't read in general. But the part of the population that still wants information before they vote, before they go shopping, before they buy a car, before they do a lot of travel, or before they cook a meal, where do they go to? They go to journalism. They go to people who are spending their days researching, reporting on something, and presenting it to them. I still think there's I don't know if it's a majority of Americans, but I think there's still a good number of people who want that and see that its importance in a liberal democracy.
Well, Dan, speaking of where we are, the future, where we're heading, I texted you the other day that when you wrote the column about an apology to the class of 2020, and again, to our listeners throughout the region on Baltimore Positive, go to the Sun website or Google Dan Broderick's apology to the class of 2020. Dan, I said to you, and I meant it, heartfelt, that out of your... I don't know that I've read all 6,000 columns, but I probably have.
It only felt like 5,000.
5,550 of them. And I said, out of the 6,000 columns, I thought that was in the Roderick's Hall of Fame. And for folks who didn't read it, give them a gist, give them sort of an overview of your sentiment in that. Because you were speaking to my granddaughter, who's graduating from Catonsville High School virtually in a week or so, and I immediately, as I texted you that morning, I sent her the link, and I said, hey, Ellie, I want you to read this. My friend Dan Roderick is apologizing to your class. Give our listeners a sense of why you felt it was important to apologize to the class of 2020.
Well, I'm a baby boomer, and I've been thinking about what's happened the last 3 years since Trump's election specifically, but even before that, mass shootings. We started off with 50 million people without health insurance. We got it down a bit, and then the resistance pushed it back up again. We still abide a system where not everybody has access to affordable health care. And then this pandemic hits, and we're questioning science. We're not doing anything on climate change at the national level. Some governors are trying to get things going there. Industry is adjusting somewhat, but we seem to be in a regressive stage when it comes to things that I thought would always be moving along, that there would always be progress in America. You have a technological advances, amazing things that this country can produce, incredibly smart people, many of them immigrants who contribute to our healthcare, our business in America, keeps this country moving and makes it the richest country in the world. And why we're in this period of regression, where actually other countries are doing better than we are in dealing with a health crisis that we haven't seen in 100 years, why we have a president who spends Memorial Day weekend attacking his enemies in the most in ugly and vindictive ways, when the nation usually turns to mourning and reverence and reflection on Memorial Day weekend.
A disgrace. On a daily basis, it is really tough to stomach.
It is.
If that were my daughter, Dan,
I just wanted to say the apology is we should have been in a better place by now.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, we're not. I, I apologize to my kids, who are now, my son is 30, my daughter's 27. You know, I'm sorry. I can't believe right. Trump is president. We went from Obama to Trump. I'm sorry, kids. I don't understand how this happened. Something went wrong. And every time there's a mass shooting, I say, well, what are we going to do? When are we going to do something about this? So that's what fed into my wanting to congratulate the class for getting through the high school or college, but also to apologize to them.
Well, it is, again, to our listeners, it is a brilliant column. It is one that if you still do get a hard copy, you ought to cut out and just keep on your desk. If you get it digitally, hit click and print it out, because it really does capture the feelings of so many of us. So
hey, Don, I got to say something to you. I thank you for saying that, but I heard from many people who felt the same way I do, who have been thinking about all this too, as they get older. You know, they got grandchildren. You could get sick and die during this pandemic. Who knows? And there's this like panic that we're leaving the country in this condition for this next generation. And we left too much on their plate to handle. You know,
well,
it should have been.
But then, and I'm not. Listen, I tend to think of myself as an optimistic guy. I had a coworker.
We all are, by the way. I would think of the three of us as optimistic people.
Right. I had a coworker one day say to me, he said, man, you are the pony boy. And I thought, but what? He said, you're a pony boy. I said, what in the hell is a pony boy? He said, you're the guy who comes down a kid on Christmas morning and there's a pile of poo under a tree and you say, oh man, there must be a horse here somewhere. He said, you're the pony boy. I tend to think I'm an optimistic guy. But
yeah.
I have to tell you, that optimism is being tested.
No, but that's what this election's about. That's why we get together and vote.
Correct. If on November the 3rd of this year, and actually I'm going to tell you why I'm not as optimistic as I normally am on both scenarios. If on November the 3rd, the Electoral College, because it's coming, I think it's clear Biden's going to win. If Hillary won by 3 million in the popular vote, I'm pretty comfortable that Biden's going to win somewhere between 4 to 5 million more in the popular vote, but it doesn't matter. So if somehow in this aberration that we call the Electoral College puts Trump back in, then the number of people in my circle who are not just overreacting, but who are seriously saying to me, I am going to have to take a hard look as to whether or not this is the country I want to live in, they're serious. And that's terrifying me. The flip side is, let's assume we wake up on November the 4th and the American people do speak and say, we've had enough. We're just tired. We're going with Joe Biden. I don't have any belief whatsoever that Trump will go quietly into the good night. I believe, and my brother espoused this 5 years ago, and I thought, I wasn't sure he was correct, and the more I look back at it, I think he was. My brother always had the idea that Trump never wanted to be president anyway, that it was all about creating Trump TV network and getting his ratings up and getting his base fired up, and that when he lost, he would then go challenge Fox News and become the new Roger Ailes and a billionaire, and then all of a sudden he was like the candidate, and he woke up and he said, well, what do we do now? I'm president. I'm pretty confident that if Trump loses again after he screams and shouts about the election being rigged, that we'll be looking at Trump TV, which will only drive us further into our bunkers. And I don't know how we survive in these bunkers that we've created, Dan.
Yeah, that's the biggest problem is described by a man I met on the number 51 bus a few months ago, who asked me if Trump was going to be impeached. And I said, yeah, he's probably going to be impeached. I don't know if he'll be convicted, but he'll be impeached. And this older man said to me, well, it's not him I worry about. It's the 63 million who voted for him.
Right. Correct. You know, that's where I am.
Yeah. We still have a country that opted for him and still supports him, I guess. You know, when you look at his approval rating, I can't believe, you know, like 40% of people think he's doing a good job with this pandemic when he basically said, screw it, I'm going golfing.
Right.
I'm astonished on a daily basis. I'm from Dundalk. You know, I'm on Facebook. I am just blown away by people that can 3.5 years into this watch this and say, that's my guy. How can he not be your guy too? You know, Dan right. Rodericks is our guest. You can follow along, read his columns, read his work. I follow him on Facebook and Twitter, and you can as well. Last thing, Dan, and I want to leave this on somewhat of a light note here during as I'm holding this up, but my life will not be complete if at some point I don't fly fish with you. And I say this with all due respect and reverence. Lefty Cray, when I was a young man, would always come in early in the morning. You know, seven in the early bird gets the worm. And I would still be there. And at 7 a.m, he'd come in and say, oh, Nestor, I'm going to take you out. We're going to teach you how to fly fish. Marlo and I'll take you out. And I never went with Lefty. And I know you've written at length about Lefty and books about Lefty. I had Tony Tochterman on. We talked about Lefty. Don, this would be Tiger Woods wanting to play golf with you and saying, nah, I don't want to play golf. Or this would be, you know, it's just, I said no to Lefty Cray, so therefore I need to at least have you touch me so that I can do it. And the only reason I'm even interested in this is 2.5 years ago, my wife and I went to Yellowstone Park, and we went to see Pearl Jam, of course, in Missoula, Montana, but we drove from Boise. And in addition to the craters of the moon in Idaho, which everyone in the world should see once, the trip through Yellowstone Park made me want to fly fish, because every corner I turned, there was a hill, a cliff, a waterfall, and some guy like you in waders looking like he was having the greatest day of his life. And I thought, I'm not going to golf when I get older. I'm not going to play tennis. I'm not going to bitch on the internet. I'm going to learn how to fly fish, and that's how I'm going to get old, Dan. And I've never done it.
Well, I'd be glad to take you. My son, Nick, has become a trout whisperer. He's really a good fly fisherman, and he's starting his own guide service now called Fisher Cat.
Oh, wow.
And, I have my book from last year, Father's Day Creek, is out. It's a good Father's Day present, by the way. It's about fly fishing, and it's not a how-to so much as why we do it. So you might want to read that to give you a sense of it. And then I'll be glad to take you out fly fishing. You know, speaking of Lefty Cray, he was a legendary fly fisherman who died a year or so ago. He wrote the foreword for my book. It might have been the last thing that he composed for anybody. But when we were out casting, he was giving me a casting lesson, and he says to me, "What are you doing? You look like a monkey hauling cabbage." And I said, "What? What did you just say?"
And I can see him saying it. Like, I can see his face saying that. I can see the expression of disgust on his face,
One last thing. I used to sit in the newsroom. Lefty used to be in the newsroom of the Morning Sun. He would come in very early to write his columns about the outdoors. And I'd get there like 7 a.m., 8 a.m., and I'd walk past him. And his greeting to me would always be something like, "Did you hear the one about the nun and the firefighter?" He told jokes all the time. Yet he was really a larger-than-life personality. And I was lucky. You know, when he was very sick, I didn't think he was. I asked him to write the foreword for my book, and he said he couldn't do it. And then a few months later, he called me up and said he was feeling better. I went out to his house in Cockeysville, and he basically dictated it to me. I'll be forever grateful for that.
Wow.
So,
Grace. Well, Nestor wanted to end with Lefty and your love of fishing, and it certainly is legendary. I can't let you go. I joked early. Always like to talk to our guests about who they are today and how who they are today is reflected by how they grew up. As I said, I used to love your columns about the lovely Rose Popola. Tell us a little bit about your mom and which part of your mom is still with you every day.
Oh, my God. Well, I cook every day. That's what she did. And I guess my love of cooking comes from her. I'm going to make I got some homemade fettuccine I'm going to make tonight. That thing, and I guess just having a good laugh and, basically getting drunk on one cocktail. That's what I've inherited from my mother.
What was Rose's cocktail?
Highballs. She always drank a highball.
No wonder it only took one.
Yeah. Took a highball. She was through the roof. One year, she was born on St. Patrick's Day, so the former Rose Popolo was born on the Irish anniversary. And Nestor, this is back when I had the radio show on WBAL. I called her up to wish her happy birthday. And I said, "What have you been doing today?" She said, "Well, I had a Irish coffee this morning. I said, that involves whiskey, right? He said, oh, yeah, Irish coffee. And then your sister took me to Holy Cross Cathedral in Boston. We went to Mass. Then we went to lunch, and I had a Guinnessy beer. A Guinness okay. beer. And then I had a Bailey's Irish cream. And then I went to my son-in-law's house, your brother-in-law, and he gave me a Jameson. That was good. This is like 11 o'clock at night. My mother is... I just couldn't believe how much she drank in one day. Usually it was just one highball, and that was it for her.
Well, so, Dan, anyway. You know, we've been friends, you know, on Facebook. My mother's been gone 2.5 years, but my mom drank a beer every day of her life. I never put a picture of my mother up on the web without a beer. The beer weighed 12 ounces. She weighed 64 pounds. So, you know what I mean? Hey, we obviously are, you know, big fans of your work and big fans of the Sun and former colleagues and all that. We appreciate taking some time. And I'm sorry I told you it'd be a half an hour. It's never half an hour with Mohler. It's always an hour. All right.
It's fun. No, this was fun. I enjoyed talking to you guys.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. Well, thank you for inviting me.
I'll never be a good fisherman. I talk too much.
Put that back on, Dan, after the election and try to analyze what happened.
That would be fine with me. And also, yeah. Nestor, at some point, you know, when this pandemic is, I don't know, when we can do it safely, I'll take you fly fishing.
I would love that. And the worst part, well, the best part is you won't have to talk to me because you can say to me, shh, you're scaring the fish, shut up. And my wife really wants to go so she can just do that. You know what I mean? And an entirely quiet day with me on a pond. Imagine
all
it.
Right.
Yeah. All right. And Dan, Mike sent me a text. He said, you got to get back out. The fish are running. He wants you on the boat and go out and catch some of those rockfish down there in Cambridge.
And the little chop tank. Okay, well, thank you for the invitation.
You got it. I just want to have some fresh lemon and pepper on that rockfish. Don Mohler, former Baltimore County executive, is my partner for Baltimore Positive. Dan Rogers, of course, you can find out at the Baltimore Sun and Save Our Sun and winning Pulitzers and holding people like these people on the ballot accountable once they are elected. So please vote. We're telling everybody to do that. Out of Baltimore Positive, all the mayoral candidates are also candidates for Baltimore City Council President as well as controller and all sorts of evaluations, prognostications, and dissertations, I should say. I am Nestor. We are WNST.net, AM 1570, Towson, Baltimore. Keeping calm, staying local. Nothing more Baltimore positive than having Dan Rodericks around here today.